Okay, chapter 9, section 5. Let's get through these. Wilson, again, when he's elected president after the Republican Party split in 1912, is most known for antitrust legislation and financial reforms. The two key pieces of antitrust legislation, the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914, which Wilson signed into law, which attacked the mergers involving, you know, stock acquisitions, putting companies together if it created a monopoly situation. And it also, very importantly, eliminated the use of the Sherman Antitrust Act as a means by which to go after unions, which the Sherman Antitrust Act had originally been designed to go after trusts and monopolies. As it turned out, it was used maybe more as a weapon, at least initially, to break up unions. The Clayton Antitrust Act kept that from occurring. The second thing, the creation of the Federal Trade Commission in 1914, which does exactly what it sounds like it might do. It regulates and keeps an eye on trade activities to make sure, again, there aren't illegal activities, corruption, and mergers which are restraining trade in an attempt to try to create a more competitive economic environment. In terms of financial reform, there are two big ones associated with Wilson. First of all is the creation of the federal income tax. This was kind of largely done, as I remember, under Taft's presidency and then finally ratified at the beginning of Wilson's presidency. So I'm not sure how much credit he necessarily deserves, but it came about during his presidency. At that particular time, or before the federal income tax, the government raised most of its money through tariffs and other kinds of fees. The income tax was so minuscule compared to what it is today, but the whole notion of having a federal income tax that people paid into, and then all of a sudden this money started to flow into the government, and the government started to figure out, hey, we need to, this is better than doing anything we were doing before, bake sales and whatever else they were doing to pay for the government, that you will see the income tax, you know, increase, you know, tremendously over time. The idea of a graduated income tax, again, meaning that the more money you make, the higher percentage it is that you pay in taxes. That's what this thing was in 1913, and it's evolved all kinds of ways since that particular time. The other thing of significance that is associated with Wilson is the creation and his signing into law the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Federal Reserve is a difficult thing to explain. I wish I had more time to do it for you. Please take economics if you are interested in learning more about the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Act and what the Federal Reserve Bank does. But just in general, the most important thing for you to grasp for now is that basically the Federal Reserve is responsible for managing the money supply. What kind of money is in circulation in the economy? And it was in response to a really bad economic time in 1907, where very famously the financier J.P. Morgan basically loaned the government enough, think about this, one person at that time was wealthy enough to basically loan the country enough money to keep it from going bankrupt. Could not happen in this day and age with our $19 trillion debt. But anyway, the Federal Reserve was designed as a central bank, a lender of last resort, and a controller of the money supply to maybe better regulate economic activity to keep us from having some real highs and lows. There were a number of panics and, you know, semi-depressions at that particular time, and the Fed was designed to keep those things from happening. Let's get on to the women's suffrage again. Let me do this quickly. Most of the states that had given women the right to vote before there was a constitutional amendment were in the West. Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Washington, Idaho, I know are mentioned in your textbook. Kansas gave women the right to vote in 1912, you know, 7 or 8 years before a constitutional amendment. A lot of that had to do with kind of the pioneer spirit, and because women were viewed with a greater sense of equality out here on the prairie because of the kinds of jobs that women did. There wasn't seemingly as much distinction between women and men from an economic perspective at that particular time. The leaders of the early 20th century efforts for women's suffrage, the names that I would like you to know, Carrie Chapman Catt, who will be featured prominently in the movie that we watch. Again, she is more of the conservative wing of the suffragist movement. Again, the three-pronged strategy we talked about earlier, attacking on the basis of the 14th Amendment, getting state constitutions changed, and giving women the right to vote at the state level, or going perhaps for a constitutional amendment. There will be two, in particular, more, again, militant women suffragists, Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who will be at the part of that, will be at the center of that part of the suffragist movement. And again, we'll see the dynamic between those two sides play out in the movie. The 19th Amendment is the amendment ratified finally in 1920 that grants women the right to vote. Again, at that particular time, it was still in the minority of states that had given women full rights of suffrage. And again, some states had given women no rights of suffrage whatsoever, did not let them participate in any way, shape, or form in the political process. But in August of 1920, the state of Tennessee became the three-fourths of the states by which to get the amendment ratified. Tennessee came through, and in August of 1920, it became part of the Constitution. So 70-plus years going back to Seneca Falls, fighting for women's suffrage. There were some shortcomings to the progressive movement. The textbook focuses mostly on that related to black civil rights. Roosevelt had not been particularly strong on advancing black civil rights, nor had Taft, and then Wilson had actually done some things. Wilson was a Southerner and certainly had some racist leanings to him. He had increased segregation in certain elements of the government and had definitely done some things that were contrary to doing anything to advancing the cause of blacks at this particular time. And that is certainly one of the main, if not the main, shortcoming of the progressive movement, is very little was addressed in terms of advancing any change related to Jim Crow laws or political disenfranchisement of blacks in the South and other places in the United States. Some people have also pointed to what ultimately becomes, a position of anti-immigrant sentiment, which ultimately leads to the passage of anti-immigration laws. Some do not pin that on the progressives. Some do pin it on them in part, as they again began to have concerns about the direction that the country was going and how the makeup of the country was changing. There is certainly agreement on the fact that the progressive era largely comes to an end with World War I and the United States' involvement in the so-called Great War.